This morning, I'm going to do something just a little bit different from, I guess, what you might say is my standard mode of operation. Most of the readings that we're going to do are going to be a bit longer, and so, as I don't usually have a PowerPoint, I decided to have one of those to help you follow along with the chapters we're going to read. And I'd encourage you, after we finish the readings, keep a Bible open or something open to those chapters as we refer back to them. I think it'll be helpful for you to look at some of the details we're going to notice, some of the things we're going to draw out. The book of Daniel has really always been one of my favorites in the Old Testament. Over the years, I've heard several excellent lessons that explored the prophecies and dreams that are recorded in the book bearing his name. And studying those prophecies will really deepen your faith and fill you with awe at the power and foreknowledge of God, the things that he foretold through Daniel and was able to do. Daniel really is an interesting book in that not only does it contain these several chapters of these edifying prophecies, but it also has several accounts from the life of Daniel and some others that hold great appeal to younger people, some of which I remember fondly from my childhood, hearing these stories over and over again. In the first six chapters are several accounts that cover several situations which four young Hebrew men named Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah faced after being taken from their homes by King Nebuchadnezzar when he conquered Jerusalem. And today, I want to look at three of these situations in three different chapters, and from them, see how God can make us 10 times better than anyone or anything in the world ever could. Chapter 1 of Daniel begins with King Nebuchadnezzar's siege of Jerusalem and his conquest of the city. Now, he won this city, as the Bible says that God gave it to his hand, because Jehoiakim, the current king of Jerusalem and of Israel, was unfaithful to the Lord and he was wicked in his sight. So the Lord gave the city over to Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to pick up our reading in Daniel 1 and verse 3. The king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily provision of his delicacies and wine and 3 years of training for them so that they might serve before him. Now from among the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's delicacies nor the wine. Therefore he made a request of Ashpenaz that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of Ashpenaz, and he said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. Why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? You would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to Ashpenaz's steward, "Please test your servant for 10 days and give us vegetables and water. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the young men who eat the king's delicacies be examined, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of the delicacies and wine and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, Ashpenaz brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. In all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all of his realm. Now again, our reading starts with this command from the king to Ashpenaz to select certain young men for service. These young men had to be good-looking, gifted in wisdom, knowledgeable and quick to understand, able to serve. Further, the king had appointed them certain advantages, such as instruction in the language and literature of the Chaldeans, a portion of his delicacies and wine, and 3 years of training for service. In these qualifiers, as well as in the goals and advantages that the king had in mind for them, what we see is a clear picture of things that are highly valued in the world of the Chaldeans and in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, it's not hard to see why, as looking through those things, we can all quickly realize that these same things are highly valued today. They were prized tens of years ago, hundreds and thousands of years ago. The world values knowledge, wisdom, and intelligence. Men and women today devote their lives to the pursuit of all of these things, especially beauty, youth, and usefulness. And it's somewhat amazing to see how little the world has changed after all these years. Now, Daniel's response to his situation and the king's offer holds some important lessons for us. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah may have been selected by Ashpenaz to serve King Nebuchadnezzar, something that many today would find to be an astounding and undismissible opportunity for which they would give any price and make any sacrifice. But these wise young men, as we're going to see over and over, were already fully committed to serving the Lord. So Daniel decides to reject portions of the king's offer which contradict the Lord's will. Though this may seem like a small or insignificant thing, it was a bold decision on Daniel's part that could potentially cost not only his own life, but the lives of his friends and of Ashpenaz for even granting this request. Daniel displays the sort of devotion that we must have to the Lord if we are truly one of his people, truly dedicated to following God and obeying his will. Daniel convinces Ashpenaz to bear with them for 10 days and test their alternative to the king's dietary plan and see if this will be acceptable after this time. And he finds them better off than those who partook of the king's things. Notice the transition there in verses 16 and 17. When they were tested and found better, Ashpenaz took away the fine things of men. And in contrast, in the next verse, we see that God gave to these same young men gifts of knowledge and skill in literature and wisdom. The things that God gave them, as opposed to the things they lost, were far more precious, even in man's eyes, than the things that Ashpenaz could have offered, that the king did offer. So Daniel and the others continue on in obedience to the Lord rather than the king for this entire 3 years, during which we find that God has blessed them in knowledge and wisdom so much so that at the end they have no match in the nation. We also see that God gives Daniel understanding in all visions and dreams. And it's worth noticing that their skills and abilities and the things which the king desired them to have are not attributed to the training that they received for those 3 years, but they're identified as gifts from God. We can also compare those things that they are blessed in during that time to the qualifiers that the king first said to look for that were found in these young men, and infer that these also were gifts from God. They came from somewhere, and from the pattern we see here, they must have come from God. God values many of the same things that man does, and freely gives them to his children. Finally, we see the result of their obedience. God made them 10 times better than anyone else in the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. And I can't stress enough how important the lesson is for us here. Nothing that man can offer us, nothing that man thinks is best or most important in this life, is going to make you better than what God could make you in the end. Obedience to God above all else is going to make you so much better and lead you to become something far better than anything you could have dreamed, anything you could have aspired to be by using the world's means. Daniel and the others are not a unique circumstance, but instead are results of God's pattern of operation and his way of blessing his people. You might also consider what the Bible says about Joseph in Genesis 41, 38 through 41. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." In Luke 14 and verse 11, Jesus says something that, when you first read it, seems to be a paradox, but really it's a profound truth about God's methods, which are well illustrated here in the lives of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Jesus said, "For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." And you might say, that's all fine and good to see that Joseph and Daniel and others in the Old Testament and in the Bible were blessed by God, so much so that they became great in their respective kingdoms. But how does this really apply to us today? God doesn't work that way anymore. But that way of thinking is a little bit flawed. True, God does not necessarily operate in all the same ways as he did in the Old Testament times. Maybe he doesn't expect us to become or lead us to become some high ruling class within the governments and nations of our time. But his methods don't change in such a way that they will break his patterns of operation with his people. They're not going to change the way he blesses his people. God has gifted us with the full revelation of his will to study, to learn, and to follow. So, to be like Daniel, one simple answer we could find is in the words of Paul in 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. He said that all scripture was given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God or the child of God may be complete and thoroughly equipped for every good work. Now in Daniel chapter 1, this prominence and growth for the four young Hebrew men is presented from the perspective and from the concept of being a gracious gift from God. And the chapters we're going to examine next kind of change gears, change their tactics a bit from these, and we're going to see how those who will receive God's gifts also had their own role to play in this relationship between man and God. Each of these young men faced trials in their faith, and by perseverance, we'll find that God bountifully blesses them even more. As we move to our next portion of Daniel, I did want to summarize a few things from Daniel chapter 2. We're not going to read that chapter, but it helps kind of set the stage for Daniel chapter 3. Daniel 2 begins in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and he's having troubling dreams and decides to call together all of the magicians and sorcerers, astrologers, and the Chaldeans to help interpret his dreams. He promises them great rewards if they can relieve his troubled mind, but he offers them death if they fail to accomplish his mission. None of these people can fulfill his request, and so the king begins to execute all of these wise men in the land. And this puts the lives of Daniel and the others at risk. Daniel again is bold in his action, and he goes before the king to fulfill his request for the interpretation. And through God's gift, Daniel explains the dream to the king, that wonderful story about the great image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and he saves his friends, he saves the remaining wise men, he glorifies God in this process, and at the end, he gets himself, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego promoted to even higher offices within the kingdom. Now, as we move on to Daniel chapter 3, I wanted to point out two interesting things that I also noticed while studying chapter 2 in preparation for this morning. First, in Daniel 2, 46 through 49, we're going to read just this little section real quick. We find a beautiful illustration of Jesus' words in Luke 14 and 11, which we read just a moment ago. And it says, "King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel, saying, 'Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret.' Then the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all Babylon's wise men. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king." Now, that passage is especially vivid to me immediately, having considered Jesus' words in Luke 14, 11. But you can apply these words of Jesus to much of the book of Daniel. As he and the other Hebrew men rise to these great positions of power by their humility and obedience to God, and likewise it applies very well to the fall of Nebuchadnezzar as he continually tries to exalt and raise himself up as a god, especially in the account of his great humiliation in Daniel chapter 4. Now, based on the king's reaction to Daniel's interpretation of his dream and what he does in the next chapter, it seems to me that maybe he stopped listening after hearing Daniel say, "You are the head of gold on that great statue." Either he wasn't listening, or he heard, or decided to make what he wanted. Either way, I think it's a relatively safe guess that Nebuchadnezzar's dream was the inspiration for the great image that he sets up here in the beginning of Daniel chapter 3. Now, in Daniel chapter 2, we read about the first major problem or evidence of this persecution and this trial against the children of God, of how Nebuchadnezzar was going to execute all the wise men, and it would have included these four young men. In Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come face to face with death due directly to their faith in God. Nebuchadnezzar commands all the officials in his kingdom to gather before his great gold image that he set up at its dedication and to fall before it and worship when music plays. Now, obviously, this is not something that these three young men of faith can do while remaining faithful to God, and so they don't follow the king's command. This causes some of the Chaldeans to accuse them of violating King Nebuchadnezzar's orders. And this is where we pick up our reading again in Daniel 3 and verse 13. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" They answered the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve can deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand. But if not, let it be known to you that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward them. He commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated, and for mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind them and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they fell down bound into the midst of the furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they said, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men walking loose amidst the fire. They are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the furnace and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then they came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered and saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Now this time, when these young men disobeyed the king, there really, as far as anyone could see, was nothing standing in the way of their death. There wasn't really a trial period or an alternative the king might find acceptable, but you can see the king must have respected them for even giving them a second chance, a second opportunity to obey him, to bow down and worship. However, their response implies that the king should have already known what their answer would be to this challenge. Their actions up until now should have answered his question whether they would bow before a god besides the Lord. Only a few verses ago, before this reading, this king was bowed down on his face before Daniel, saying, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the King, the Lord of kings." But now he's asking them, he's commanding them to abandon their faith in the Lord of Kings, the God of gods, and commit idol worship. The king also previously answered his own foolish question, "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" It is the God of gods. Therefore, they had no need to answer him. He already knew. It's amazing how quickly he seems to forget, how quickly he jumps back and forth from trying to destroy God's people. And then the next second, he's praising God and promoting them within his kingdom. And just as we saw in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar now aims to kill these men. But upon seeing them unharmed by the furnace, even though he made it 7 times hotter, he calls them back out and begins to glorify God, again, giving them more power and authority at the end than he did at the beginning. Once again, we can make some application of a few New Testament passages to this account, which serves as a great illustration of the comforting truths we read here. Both passages I want to notice come from 1 Peter. The first is 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Now, I don't just pick that because it says fire, although I think it applies. But I think it's interesting if you think about the contrast between what is said in 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7, and what's happened here with the fiery furnace. They were thrown into this fire where their faith was tested, just like 1 Peter says, because they would not bow down to a gold image. And at the end, when Nebuchadnezzar sees that they were unharmed, absolutely untouched by this fire, he bows down to these men of faith and sees how valuable that faith was and glorifies God again. Then in 1 Peter 4, verses 12 and 13, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy." Even in the direst circumstances in which we might find ourselves, we need to trust God. These three men knew that they could not waver in their faith, and that whether God delivered them from this death in the furnace or not, they wanted the king to know that they would not now or ever worship a false god. The fiery furnace serves as a wonderful reminder of these metaphoric fires of persecution and trial, which in the end, when we survive them, serve to purify and strengthen us, to make us better than we were before. They will not destroy us unless we turn away from God and abandon our faith in him. And that is when we can say all hope is lost. To persevere, however, brings great things, not only for us personally, but also for those who witness your triumph over the fire. We read in the account of the fiery furnace that the Son of God was walking with them through the midst of the fire, and we too have a similar assurance. Many times in the New Testament, it speaks of God being with us in our trials. And in 1 Peter 4, it says we're partakers of Christ's sufferings. We're not alone in facing those things that we have to face. He's always with us and will see us through those dark days that come. Now, our last account is going to come from Daniel chapter 6, when he, much like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with this great image, is challenged in his faith by the threat of death. Some time has passed since the events with King Nebuchadnezzar, and now a new king named Darius is ruler of Babylon. Our reading picks up as he is organizing the kingdom under his reign in Daniel 6 and verse 1. "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these 3 governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." That's a lot like Joseph and Pharaoh, because this man has the spirit of God. "So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, 'We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it concerning the law of his God.' So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks to before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God, and they went before the kings and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. The king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun. Then these men approached the king and said, Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians, and that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, Your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now the king went to his place and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. When he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And, O king, I have done no wrong before you. The king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take him up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever could be found on him, because he believed in his God. The king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Now for a moment, consider just how powerful Daniel's influence is in this chapter and in the kingdom. Daniel, under more than one ruler, has proven himself worthy of the highest positions of leadership in the kingdom. And in this case, he's one of three governors over all 120 satraps of the kingdom. He excelled so much, the king is considering setting him over the whole realm. Others in the kingdom became jealous of his prominence and position, but notice, they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. He was faithful to God, and he was faithful to the king. We've seen previously how faithful that Daniel and the others were toward God, but did you know that a child of God must be equally faithful to men in the world, provided it does not interfere with their relationship with God? Daniel was faithful to his ruler and essentially his employer. Surely he was also faithful to those under his authority. He must have been a good man. From the standpoint of an employer or a king, men like Daniel are the sort that you want to promote up the ranks, the sort you can trust. And there's a reason that he wants to make this the second in the kingdom, second only to himself and the throne. Yet there will always be those who don't like you for your morality, for your honesty, and especially for your gain, if you gain from those things. And so these men around Daniel sought to cause trouble for him due to his faith. But they couldn't really accomplish their goal without Daniel's help, it would seem. Notice the lie that they told the king. King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, that includes Daniel, the satraps and administrators, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Does that sound like something that Daniel would have consulted with and agreed to? But they claimed he was involved in this great meeting, this great consultation of all the rulers of the land. And so these men decided and succeeded in turning the law against Daniel and against the Lord. Now, doesn't that sound a little bit familiar today? Especially in the last few years, the last few decades, though it's never been heavily for Christianity, our culture has quickly and decidedly been turning against it. There are growing movements and factions of people who believe you are extremely unintelligent if you believe in God, if you worship anything, if you are religious of any sort. Many people today want to see you jailed for bigotry and discrimination, for daring to have a religious conviction that they disagree with. And certainly they do not want to see you succeed in a career or have a happy life. Seems their goal is to find you and to throw you out of society. The traditional model of a family is now a thing of scorn, and church to most people in the world is somewhere you might go on certain holidays if you go at all. But that's not how it should be for a dedicated Christian. No, the Christian should be like Daniel in the face of increasing opposition. If a law is passed that prohibits you from worshiping God, from serving him as he's commanded, or the law opposes his teachings, we do not have a right to follow the laws of men rather than remain obedient to God. Daniel shows us this when he refused to submit to Darius's ordinance, and he knelt on his knees 3 times that very day and prayed and gave thanks before his God with his windows open. Who cares who sees? This was his custom since early days. Daniel's faith was practiced and practical. It was a lifelong commitment to God, and not one thing changing in the world was ever going to stop him from following the Lord. Now look at the effect that Daniel had on those around him. His faith caused others to despise him, that's true. But look how the king reacted on learning that Daniel had violated his command. And think about it, it was the first day. It was probably as soon as these men got the decree signed, I'm sure they ran off to start watching Daniel. And as soon as he heard about the decree, I kind of wonder who he learned it from, he immediately went and prayed. I doubt much time had passed. And if you were a king and had just signed into this law some decree of people not to worship anyone but you, you'd probably be a little bit offended, a little angry, maybe a little betrayed by someone you love so much and trusted. But the king reacts, and it says, when he heard these words, he was greatly displeased with himself. He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun. You'll notice one of the things he did was he went and he put a signet ring on that stone as he said those words about Daniel being saved. And then he also used the signets of his lords. That's very similar to what he did in putting that ordinance into law. That could not be changed. The king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No musicians, no entertainment for him. His sleep went from him. And he arose very early in the morning, as soon as he could, as soon as it was technically legally fulfilled, I suppose, the commands of that ordinance to check on Daniel at the den of lions. The king was worried about him, and he was overjoyed to see that Daniel survived the night and understood it was by the power of his God. This led the king to write a new decree, commanding everyone in the kingdom to fear the living God, to recognize who he was and his power and dominion. So how amazing is Daniel's influence? The truth is that you can have a similar sort of influence today. What made Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah 10 times better than the other young men around them, than the other rulers and people in the kingdom? What enabled them to survive trials and fires that were 7 times worse than any normal man could face? Even these mighty men of valor trying to throw them into the furnace died without ever entering the furnace. The story of Daniel and the lions then gives us the answer when it says that he prayed 3 times daily. Daniel had a system and a pattern of life. He did not let it change. The truth is that Daniel and the others are fully dedicated to the Lord. Their faith is active. It is definite. It is unchanging. They have routines and habits of worshiping God, of calling on Him in their lives, and of trusting in Him when all other hopes are gone. God is not an afterthought in extra moments of their time that they simply cannot fill with anything else. God is first, foremost, and frequent in their life. In each case, the lives of these four men were threatened, and in each case, God delivered them. Each time, they were given more and more blessings from God, which led the men around them to eventually respect and follow them, glorifying God in the process. And you see that those who were active in opposing these men of God, who would not change their ways and recognize God, were destroyed by their own ambitions. Each of these men had deep commitments to God, which would not be superseded by any of man's requirements or expectations. In Daniel 1 and in Daniel 6, we see that these commitments did not begin late in life, but rather their interest and devotion to God began in their youth. It stayed with them through all of these trials and hardships. We also saw just how far they were willing to go in dedication to God. In all three accounts, their lives were on the line. In Daniel 3, we saw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not begin to bow before other gods, even if the king of the most powerful empire at the time demanded it. And in Daniel 6, we likewise saw that Daniel would not cease to bow before God, even though it was illegal to do so. These young men are shining examples from whom there's a lot more that we could learn than our time would allow us today. But they really were 10 times better due to their faithful commitment to God. So how do we today become 10 times better than our wildest imaginations? Start by making your obedience to God systematic. Make it the very core of your life, the foundation of everything that you do. A simple way to go about beginning this is start by praying at least 3 times a day. And I don't mean pray before every meal. That's not the kind of pattern that Daniel had. We don't see that pattern in the Bible. That's just a habit we've developed over the years. But take time 3 times. Take time. Don't just when food comes before you remember to pray. Take time and set it aside and say, I'm going to go to God at this time. This is God's time. Begin there. But don't stop there. Add to your habits of prayer the reading and study of God's word. That would be a good opportunity for one of your times of prayer. Pray fervently before or even after your study. Further, put that reading, that study, all those things, put it into practice. Practice your faith. When God's teachings are in action in your life, you will begin to see life-changing effects. You'll become a much different person. You'll realize you have more self-control than you ever thought. You have more abilities than you might have recognized. Second, you'll find that you're able to face trials and persecution. And do so. Face them head on. Don't turn and run and hide from these things. A lot of us recognize things that come into our lives as trials when maybe they're just opportunities. Don't shy away from confronting someone who is speaking disgracefully about God, especially if they know that you are a Christian. Talk to them about it. Don't shy away from an opportunity to speak to someone about the gospel, but especially consider trials and persecution that come due to religion, due to your faith, as something to be faced and overcome. Remember that when the Lord is with you, you can easily face fire 7 times hotter than you could on your own. Easily. You can probably face something much worse. Those men that faced that furnace came out completely untouched and unscathed. And that fire was 7 times hotter. As we read, persecutions that we endure will serve to purify and make us stronger in the end than we were in the beginning. And so it's really a simple 2-step plan when you think about it. Pray 3 times daily, endure fire 7 times hotter, and in the end, you will prove to be 10 times better. And the end of all of these things, in each of these accounts, was to glorify God. Teach others about who he was and show the genuineness of your faith before the world. If there's someone here who is ready to begin their walk with God, the process is simple. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and are ready to confess your faith and belief before men, repent of your sins. Turn away from your life contrary to his will. Put those things aside and commit to following after the Lord and the Lord only, above all and through all. Come forward, make your decision known. We will baptize you in his name, by which you will be washed in the blood of the blessed Lamb and be added to his church. And if you are here and already a child of God, you've not been living the way you should have. There's sin in your life that you need to repent of and confess. We're also ready to assist you in being reconciled to God. If you have a need that we can help you with, we invite you to come forward as we sing.